You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good morning, Birdland. I'm Mark Brown. I've been covering the Orioles for more than a decade on CamdenChat.com and hosting this podcast for 102 episodes and counting. It is now March the 25th, 2024. Opening day is now just 3 days away, assuming it doesn't rain enough to make opening day 4 days away. I gotta tell you, I'm less excited for opening day than I was this time last week, because the Orioles choosing to send Jackson Holliday to the minors to start the season has put a bit of a damper on my good feelings about the coming 2024 Orioles season. So in today's episode, I'm going to go into a bit of a rant mode about that decision, because honestly, it sucks. The weekend brought one other bit of Orioles-connected news not related to the roster, as the team announced on Saturday afternoon that owner Peter Angelos passed away at age 94. His 30-year tenure as owner of the team, the last few of which were overseen by his older son John as Peter's health declined and he receded from public view, has had more than its share of downsides, it must be said. Anyone out there who is thinking mostly about the assorted bad things, I don't blame you. There are a number of them. You don't have to think very hard to come up with any of them. Going back to his antics in the 90s with feuding with managers, general managers, broadcasters, whatever, not long after he first took over the team, on into what really seems like it was his final real piece of influence involving the Orioles when Peter Angelos had reportedly directly negotiated with Scott Boras about the Chris Davis contract. The Orioles will be paying for that decision literally until I am 53 years old, and I just turned 40 last year because I am younger than the last Orioles World Series title. So, as enduring legacies go, there are definitely a lot of big negatives on that one. But I think overall, Angelos deserves to be remembered as a positive for his impact on the city, and even with positives about the Orioles, because though it is easy to forget now, Angelos leading the group that bought the team in the first place was something that saved the Orioles from capricious out-of-town ownership. The second-place bidder at the time was Jeffrey Loria, who went on to ruin baseball in Montreal and later put a torpedo through the hull of the Marlins franchise for a while as well. You might even say it has not fully recovered from that over a long period of time, although there have been a few semi-successful seasons along the way for the now Miami Marlins. And you know, when it comes to Angelos' big successes as a lawyer, the takedowns over asbestos lawsuits because manufacturers knew that product was harming people, and tobacco companies who knew the same about their product. I mean, those are some really truly righteous pieces of life's work, I think. And about the tobacco lawsuit, I mean, Angelos made so much money for the state of Maryland when he took up the tobacco lawsuit that the government of Maryland literally just refused to pay Angelos the previously agreed upon percentage because the number he ultimately got was such a large one and it was such a shock. They just refused to pay him that much. So honestly, I always thought that was kind of rude to renege on the deal like that, but Angelos, I guess, got over it and probably put some of that tobacco money into the Orioles payrolls of the late 90s and early 2000s. Not that it did the team any good to have those large payrolls relative to the rest of the league in those years. But, you know, if we had not had any news of the pending sale of the Orioles by the time Angelos passed away, this would have been a tougher thing to handle, I think, because John Angelos is really close for me to the platonic ideal of a failed son. I think we can conclude, based on nearly everything we've had to endure about him in the last 18 months or so, on into, in the days before the sale was announced, he had apparently worked out a deal for naming rights for Camden Yards that then got scuttled by the sale, I guess. So, yeah, the idea of John Angelos owning the team in his own right and maybe being stuck with him for decades was really unpalatable. But we're not going to have to deal with that unless something horrible happens, because control is going to be passed to another wealthy, locally connected guy in David Rubenstein, who I think is, I described him recently as venture capitalist and presidential history enthusiast, as he has a sorted series involving that on your local PBS station. Hopefully, Rubenstein's tenure is a much more straightforward positive for the fortunes of the franchise on the field. Things certainly seem to be headed in the right direction as he is taking over. It has been reported that since Peter Angelos has passed away, that means the Angelos family stake in the team is just going to be sold to Rubenstein's group all at once upon approval by Major League Baseball's full group of owners, rather than an initially envisioned two-step process. And the approval could apparently happen as soon as this week, which would be an exciting formality to have out of the way before the 2024 season begins. I will be right back after a message from a Fans First Sports Network sponsor, and then I'm going to fulminate against the decision to start Jackson Holiday at Norfolk.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's really just not exciting that Jackson Holiday is not going to be on the opening day roster for the Orioles. That news broke on Friday afternoon. It's 2 days later as I'm making this recording. I'm still flabbergasted by it. At the risk of being dramatic, it feels like a figurative kick in the teeth by Mike Elias. Honestly, the case to have Holiday on the big league roster to start the season was so obvious that I just took for granted the assumption that Holiday was going to make it. There was certainly little other than nitpicking to make as a case against him based on his spring training performance when combined with his 2023 minor league performance. Elias, as he usually does, spoke to the media to defend his unpopular decision, and also, as he usually does, said a bunch of stuff that was technically honest if you scrutinize it on the micro level, but I think dishonest on the macro level. He said things about how Holiday needs to spend time adjusting to playing second base, never mind that Elias could have easily known from the moment that Jordan Westberg came up and looked like a big leaguer last year that Holiday was going to need to play second base to get playing time at the major league level in 2024. The Orioles did not act on this knowledge last year, as Holiday played just 3 games at second base with Double-A Bowie and 4 games at second base with Triple-A Norfolk. So for Elias to come out and say that as an explanation here at the end of March 2024, after having spent the offseason months claiming that that Holiday would have a chance to make the team, it really doesn't seem credible to me. The other prong of Elias's justification seemed to hinge on Holiday needing more time to face high-level left-handed pitching. It is fair to say that as a left-handed batter, Holiday will have more of an uphill battle facing left-handed pitchers. But I think this fails immediately as an explanation because AAA lefties are, by their nature, not the kind of high-level pitching that Holiday is going to need to develop against. You're just not going to see the kind of stuff in a Norfolk uniform that you will in a Baltimore uniform. So it's true, Holiday only has 18 games at the Norfolk level, but he seems like he's the kind of talent where he can overcome that, and it's really disappointing that the Orioles did not end up making the same decision. Elsewhere in MLB, two other players in the top 12 prospects in baseball, who were also named Jackson and also are currently 20 years old, have made their team's rosters. Milwaukee's Jackson Chourio played in just 6 AAA games last year. San Diego's Jackson Merrill is skipping the AAA level entirely to be in the MLB. In fact, he's already made his debut because the Padres were out in Korea. Merrill, a Maryland product, had exactly 46 AA games under his belt, and Merrill got called up for the start of the season. So, I don't know. For Chourio in particular, the Brewers did work out a pre-debut contract extension with him. I'm sure that is part of the factor in why they brought him up. I don't think they would have if not for that. Merrill seems to have earned it on his own merits. And so, you know, there's two examples of teams that decided differently, literally with other guys named Jackson in the top 12 on prospect lists who are also 20 years old. So I don't know. It seems to be a pretty nakedly a case of service time manipulation, the kind of thing that was commonplace prior to the currently active collective bargaining agreement between players and owners that took effect prior to the 2022 season. That is the 7th-year loophole under which a team can leave a talented prospect in the minors for about 3 weeks and effectively gain an extra full year, nearly full year of team control before that player becomes a free agent. That used to be the norm. And now the CBA, of course, has provisions incentivizing different behavior. The Orioles have experienced both ends of those incentives, the carrot and the stick. You get a bonus draft pick if you have a top-ranked prospect on the roster all year, and that player wins Rookie of the Year. That was Gunnar Henderson last year. And the stick is if you have a guy who finishes in the top 2 of Rookie of the Year, even if he didn't get a full year of service time, once he gets that place, he gets the full year anyway. That's what happened to Adley Rutschman, even though he debuted in mid-May in 2022 after he played well enough to finish runner-up for Rookie of the Year, which, you know, if he had gotten to play the full year, which of course he didn't because of injury, but there's no allowance for, you would have had the guy on your opening day roster if not for a spring training injury that happened literally while the lockout was still going on. So whatever. Anyway, rather than waiting until April 20th or so, like a team probably would have done 3 years ago, the Orioles, now they're probably quote-unquote better off waiting until June to call up Holiday, just so that he doesn't end up having sufficient playing time that'll give him a good chance to finish in the top 2 of Rookie of the Year voting. Maybe even later than early June, depending on truly how cowardly they want to be about this. And all of this is presumably in order to preserve Holiday having team control for the Orioles or whatever team he ends up being on, much as we don't even want to think about that, in the 2030 season. Because if Holiday had debuted on opening day, stayed in MLB continuously, he otherwise would have become a free agent after the 2029 season. In baseball roster terms, 2030 is so far away, literally 0 current Orioles players will still be around on the team then, unless their contract situations change substantially. We're not just talking tacking on 1 or 2 years. We're for many players, it's add 3 or more years onto their current team control. Quite possibly neither general manager Mike Elias nor manager Brandon Hyde will still be here. And frankly, there's not even a guarantee that the new owner, Rubenstein, who's already 74 years old, will still be here. So, I mean, to be sure, it is possible that Holiday in 2030 will be better than Holiday in 2024. In fact, if he's as good as everybody thinks he is, he might even be very likely to be better 6 years from now than he is right now, because then he will have had the time to adjust to MLB and whatnot. But he's not going to reach the pinnacle of his talent and have that talent help the Orioles until he gets to test himself against major leaguers. That's what I think. I think if there's an adjustment to be made, as Rutschman took about a month to adjust in 2022, as Henderson took a couple of months to do anything other than have a good on-base percentage last year, I think the sooner that occurs, the better off the Orioles of the near future are. Because, you know, on the other hand, in 2024 here, this is the 1 year the Orioles are going to have Corbin Burnes in the starting rotation. Anthony Santander is going to be a free agent after this season, as will John Means. This is the last year before Adley Rutschman starts getting arbitration raises and taking up more of the payroll than he does right now. It is the second of 3 years where Gunnar Henderson is not going to cost very much. The Orioles have a team now that is worth investing in. They've already decided this themselves in trading D.L. Hall and Joey Ortiz to get Burnes here for just 1 year. But when it comes to putting out the best roster at the start of the season, it seems like they've made decisions due to factors other than who the best players in the roster mix are. I mean, much as we can all hope that Elias is building a sustainably good team, a good future is not guaranteed, no matter how many good players are on the roster, or even if you've got one of the best elite players in the league or several of them, once they get several years of experience, 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road. I don't think the Orioles should mortgage their whole future to reinforce the present, but when they can bolster the present while costing themselves only in the abstract for the future, again, 6 years from now, I think it should be an easy choice to choose the present. But this time, Elias chose differently. And it just makes me wonder, as a fan, I mean, what was the point for all of us enduring the terrible seasons of the not terribly distant past if on the here on the far side of it, hopefully forever, the team is still going to screw around and not give us the best possible product that it can out of its current players and prospects? Like, why did we all stick it out through the days of Stevie Wilkerson, Pat Valleca, Rio Ruiz, Pedro Severino, and so many pitchers who aren't even worth naming in a list of failed Orioles who never had a chance of getting to the far side of the rebuild? Like, why? You know, like, I believe there was an implicit promise during the tanking era that when the time came, the team would act, get its great players onto the team, not dither with those decisions due to some vague ideas of a future benefit. I say implicit because, of course, Elias never promised he would not muck around with service time once the Orioles were good. He never even promised, frankly, that the Orioles were going to be good in any specific year. They have just thankfully finally become good by winning 101 games last year. Still, I think that sending Holiday to the minors, I think, has broken a pact with fans. I think with a 101-win team last year, nearly the entire team back, I do think the Orioles are going to be good enough that we shouldn't have to angst, hopefully, about Holiday not being here for long. But if we get to the end of the season and the Orioles have come up a game or two short of something, I think it's going to be hard not to look and wonder if Holiday's absence is ultimately a big part of that ultimately small gap, if there is a gap that keeps them from something good. Of course, I spent all of last year worrying, what if the Orioles come up a game or two short of something? And they didn't. So, you know, maybe they'll do it again. That would be great. But Elias and certainly the rest of us should not count on that, I don't think. In the last episode, I talked about how the Orioles have 9 out-of-options players who cannot be assigned to the minors without potentially being lost to other teams on waivers. And I think that must have weighed a lot on Elias, because he has put 7 of these 9 guys on the roster, going, I think, very conservative at the possibility of losing guys like Mike Bauman, Jacob Webb, and ultimately even freaking Tyler Nevin made the roster, a possibility I considered absurd when he was brought back into the organization. Even a week ago, I said, you know what, we can write off Nevin, he has no chance. Well, as it turns out, the only guys who got left out are Ryan McKenna and Nick Maton. Even Tyler freaking Nevin made it. Ultimately, the Orioles have decided they would rather begin the season with Holiday in the minors, presumably Ramon Urias in the starting lineup, second base, maybe third base, and then Nevin getting playing time against left-handed pitching. I mean, we might even see Nevin as the DH on opening day against already announced Angels left-handed starter Patrick Sandoval. And that's all instead of having Holiday in the starting lineup regularly, Arias on the bench, and Nevin, who cares where. I think at the end of the season, Elias is going to have to spend time thinking long and hard about whether he has prospects who are better choices than players like Ryan Mountcastle, Austin Hayes, Jorge Mateo, and Arias again. I mean, unless things swing towards bust territory for currently high-level prospects like Heston Kjerstad, Kobe Mayo, and Connor Norby, Elias is going to have to play these guys or trade them. And if he's going to play them, he's probably going to have to either non-tender or trade or just outright release some of the more veteran players I just named who have been fine but not overwhelmingly good for the Orioles over the last couple of years. So I don't know. Maybe Nevin and Arias will end up surprising me with the way that they play this year. But if they don't, I think we're looking at Elias swinging and missing at the opportunity to have the number one prospect make his debut at the start of the season, all in order to spare putting someone on waivers who the team has really outgrown a need for them. But Elias just went really conservative with deciding that. I mean, you know, he had the whole offseason where he might have traded Arias or Mateo or whatever, and he didn't. And instead, here we are. We're going to have Nevin, Ryan Mountcastle, and Ryan O'Hearn all in the same roster. That's basically three guys who are first baseman slash designated hitter, although the Orioles might mess around with Nevin at third base sometimes. Maybe they'll put O'Hearn in the outfield. I don't know, but it's not exciting to think about those things. I will say this for Nevin being on the roster. At least you can probably guess that if he spends the first 6 weeks of the season looking like you'd expect him to look based on his big league career to date, it's not going to cost the Orioles much to chuck him into the discard pile after Memorial Day or whenever they decide to have Holiday or Norby or Mayo or whoever up and into the mix. I mean, because if Nevin is not walking into a sudden breakout in his age 27 season, I really hope that's the decision that the Orioles end up making before too long into the season. Because, you know, the fact that Nevin had a good spring, it's worth very little to me. But we did at least get one prospect who made the team. Literally, it's one. The only rookie who's going to be on the opening day roster is Colton Cowser. He also plainly deserved to be on the team, but, you know, so too did Kjerstad and Kyle Stowers. And the path for any one of these guys to be a regular starter, it's just not quite as clear-cut as long as the Hayes, Cedric Mullins, Santander outfield is intact. Which, you know, I wouldn't have guessed this 3 years ago, but that has turned out to be a perfectly cromulent and sometimes even pretty good MLB-level outfield. Cowser's first taste of MLB, it sure didn't go well last year. He mustered just a 4.33 OPS across 77 plate appearances. That wasn't enough for him to lose his rookie status, and so by making the opening day roster, he's actually going to qualify the Orioles for a potential draft pick down the road if he stays on the roster all season and wins the Rookie of the Year, of course. Or if things go really well for him over his next couple of years after this and he somehow finishes in the top three of MVP voting in the next 2 years. I remain hopeful for Cowser. I'm not that hopeful for him that I think he will eventually finish in the top three of MVP voting. But if we do see some good things from Cowser in April, I think that will take at least a little bit out of the sting of missing Holiday. But only so much, you know, you only get a top one prospect in baseball only so often. Although, I guess to Orioles fans, it does feel like an every year thing since we went from Rutschman to Henderson to Holiday. And you optimists out there who are really getting pumped about Samuel Basayo might even see him coming in four in a row this time a year from now. But, you know, I want Holiday on the team. I wanted Cowser on the team, and the Orioles just didn't find room for both of them. Hopefully, we don't end up tremendously disappointed about that decision. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic for a future episode, you can email CamdenCastPod@gmail.com to get yourself into the mailbag. That is all that I've got for today. If you enjoyed this episode and have not already subscribed, please do subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. Thank you very much. With the regular season getting underway for April and the end of here of March, I'm going to be putting out episodes every Monday and Friday morning. So I will see you again on Friday to talk about whatever happens on opening day. Or if it's a rain out on Thursday, I'll probably be back Friday morning to talk about something else anyway. Good Morning Birdland is a Camden Cast production on the Fans First Sports Network. This is Mark Brown signing off.